We'll call the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. We have two bills on the agenda today. The first is Senator Sharon with Senate File 1014. Welcome to the committee in this capacity, Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much.
You're ready, Senate File 1014.
Good morning, and thank you, Senator Lurie, for this hearing. We are wanting to make the best use of your time, so there may be many who are in this committee that have not had a chance to hear the bill and what it is that we're proposing. We just have received the most current fiscal note, which you probably are all getting a chance to look over. So let me, in terms of context, simply articulate that there are some materials in front of you that will help give you some information about the various kinds of analysis that have been done to the civil commitment process for sex offenders. What you should know, and what you probably already do know, is that sex offenders, once they're charged by the courts, spend time in jail. They do their time, and there comes a point at which they begin to complete the sentence. But at that point, the counties are alerted to the fact that these persons might be moved out of jail and on and put on parole, placed in the community. And that's the point at which there is some evaluation discussion about the terms and the conditions of release and whether or not at that point the person continues to be a threat or a danger to the public. As you know, civil commitment, whether it's for the mentally ill and dangerous or for the psychopathic sexual perpetrator, the only basis in which civil commitment can occur is if there is a proven danger to the public. So once that process occurs as a person's leaving the correction system and the counties are informed of that and there's an initial process to take a look at whether or not it is of concern that the person be released, that they should be considered for civil commitment. And in the state of Minnesota, if a civil commitment does proceed, there's only one choice for where a person goes to receive treatment for the process that makes them a danger to the public. And that's Moose Lake and the St. Peter state-operated services. Now, the auditor has done a report on the sex offenders program, and there has also been a court that we will talk about that has reviewed our process and has called upon us to make some changes in that system. The most recent court order is the one that instituted a task force to make recommendations to us about that, and we'll talk more about that if you would like to. Much of what you're seeing today is an outcome of those processes, the auditor's report and the recommended changes that came from that report, as well as recommendations from the task force ordered has been working over the last year under former Chief Justice Eric Magnuson's leadership. So with that context and understanding, that material is in front of you, the court order and the auditor's report and recommendations, so that you can look back and see. Now, this bill that we put together does not resolve all of the issues in the civil commitment process or in issues that are in the sex offenders program. It is an initial start, and it addresses a couple of areas. One is the recommendation that there be strict intensive treatment alternatives to Moose Lake and the Minnesota Sex Offenders Program in St. Peter. So in this bill, you'll see language that talks about asking the commissioner of Department of Human Services to explore what the opportunities are, what the possibilities are, that retain a high level of security and public safety while offering alternatives. There also is in this bill educational components that we felt were important so that people could understand the changes in the law and the changes in the process. And there's also some changes in the process by which a person who is committed has their status reviewed periodically. And that process, which is now a biannual review, required biannual review, Not biannual. Every two-year review? Biannual, is that every 2 years? Every 2 years. And if at that point there's enough evidence to indicate that there should be a hearing and a review and a change in the treatment process, that occurs at that time. So there are other changes in terms of what the panel of judges do and the decisions that they make. So that appeal process occurs every 2 years. And then a final change that is occurring that I think is very important for you to understand is once a person leaves the correction system and is being considered to either go through the parole process and be living in the community or considered for civil commitment, right now, because there is only one option, which is Moose Lake, there's only one step in that process. But what's in this bill, recognizing now that there'll be alternatives as we develop them, they're not in place yet, but we're taking incremental steps towards developing them, that at that point that the person leaves the correction system, there will be a what we're calling a bifurcated system. And the first step of that bifurcated system, a decision is made whether or not the person meets the criteria for civil commitment, and that would be important in order to protect the safety of the public. And then the second part of it is a separate hearing process, because once a person is determined as appropriate for civil commitment and is civilly committed by the courts, then there's a process that is going to occur in which an evaluation is done to determine where in this range of highly secure systems a person would be placed. So that's the second part of what we're calling the bifurcated system, also established by the court. So that's a very high-range kind of description of what we're doing in the project. I'll just summarize it very quickly. We asked the commissioner to begin to take a look at what's available and begin to understand and develop highly strict and intensive treatment programs to expand the options for what the court can do when civilly committed. We increase from one court process to two court processes the steps for making a decision about where a person is placed. The first step determines whether or not they meet the criteria for civil commitment, and the second is after extensive evaluation, a decision by the court for placement and the conditions of that placement. And then the final part of is what the opportunities are for people who are committed. They've already done their time, remember, so we now have committed them for true and real evaluation to occur and the opportunity to demonstrate that they're making progress in treatment and moving towards less and less restrictive incarcerations. So with that, would you like us to go step by step through the bill, or do you want us to begin to talk about the fiscal note, Senator Lurie?
Senator Sharon, I think probably the fiscal note would be the best use of our time.
Thank you. If you would indulge us a little bit, since former Chief Justice Eric Magnuson is here, I really would like to have you hear from him and hear about the work that, great deal of work that they've been doing in the task force. Senator Lurie, you are a member of that task force, so I know that you're familiar, but other members of the committee might like to hear from Judge Magnuson.
Judge Magnuson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Eric Magnuson, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. Minnesota is one of 20 states in the country that has a program for civil commitment of sex offenders, serving a civil treatment regime after the criminal sentence has been concluded. Minnesota has by far the highest per capita rate of civil commitments of any state in the country. My Vice Chair, former Chief Judge James Rosenbaum from the Federal District Court in Minnesota, has likened it to a Venus flytrap. People get in, they never get out. There are more than 600 people now in the civil commitment process. In the last three decades, only one has been released. From a constitutional standpoint, that presents a very serious issue. If you're going to civilly commit someone because they pose a threat to the public, you have to also provide treatment for them and give them an an opportunity at least to return to society. Our program in Minnesota has not been successful. That's a conclusion that has been reached by several different studies that have examined the issue. The Office of the Legislative Auditor did a very thorough report. When Governor Pawlenty was in office, he appointed a task force that examined the system in detail and came to largely the same conclusions. So we start from the premise that there's a serious issue with the system. Now, it's being challenged in federal court. The judge who is handling it, I think, has some very, very serious and legitimate concerns about the constitutionality of how the system is currently working. This is not a frivolous lawsuit. This is a lawsuit that raises very serious issues. The plaintiffs are represented by extremely competent counsel. And there is precedent in other states for the federal courts stepping in and basically taking over the system. If there's anything the state of Minnesota can do to avoid that result, it should. Because federal courts employing the Constitution do not use a scalpel. They use a broadsword. They don't care how the result gets done. They simply tell you to do it. And if you don't do it, they take consequences which do not include redesigning the system themselves, but perhaps just dismantling it. The best example of that is the California prison system. There was a lawsuit brought challenging the constitutionality of the conditions of confinement. It was successful. The federal court told the state of California, fix it. The state of California couldn't get its act together to fix it, and so the federal court started releasing prisoners. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to happen here, but if we're going to have a system of civil commitment in Minnesota, it must operate within constitutional limitations. The first steps that my task force has recommended are relatively nominal. They are to start having better treatment programs, basically, that are options to putting people behind the razor wire at Moose Lake. They are to make some changes in the civil commitment process so that the judge making the commitment has a basis for making a differentiation between the worst of the worst and someone who deserves a commitment but also doesn't fit the mold of the more severe threats by others. And finally, there needs to be a better system for moving people through the program. Now, those are the broad recommendations that are before you. And I know that you're concerned with finances. Let me just say there is probably no more expensive way to treat civil commitment than the way we're doing it now. It costs $135,000 a year to keep someone in the most secure confinement. That's the only place we can put them now. And so you're spending $75 or $80 million a year basically to keep people in a warehouse and not move them ahead. The proposal is to develop alternative programs. I believe that if the fiscal impact is not relatively neutral, it's pretty darn close to it. And if you don't do something, the estimate is by the end of this decade, there will be over 1,100 people in the program, and then you'll be spending $145 million and really achieving nothing. This bill is the result of a lot of hard work, a lot of very good thought, collaborative work with the task force, which, you know, really doesn't have a dog in the fight. We've been appointed by the federal court. There are more than 20 of us. We're former judges, current judges, prosecutors, defense lawyers, mental health professionals, and we've worked together to come up with a plan that we think is workable and achievable. And so I would urge you in the strongest terms to move this ahead. The federal court has been very patient, but it will not be patient much longer. And the last thing the state of Minnesota wants, I believe, is to let the federal government start running this program. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Justice, what are some of the guidelines, some of the guidelines that the feds are saying that you have to meet, the criteria that you have to meet for them to say, okay,
Is it just release or some kind of alternative treatment program, other proposals, or have they given you explicit direction?
The federal court has not given us any specific direction. If you go to the website that our task force has, it's housed at the DHS server, but you just do a Google search for sex offender task force. You will find, among other things, a summary of the legal issues in the Karsgens litigation. That was prepared by Dean Eric Janis of William Mitchell College of Law. It's a good summary. But the bottom line really is that if you're going to civilly commit someone, then you have to also treat them and treat them in an effective way. And that's what our system is not doing. People are not completing treatment. They're not moving ahead. They're not reducing the strictures of their confinement. And so from a constitutional standpoint, if someone has served their criminal time, in order to keep them under a civil commitment, you have to at the same time treat them. And that's in kind of the biggest terms what we're looking for. The state will have a great deal of latitude from the federal court in the details of that. But it has to do something more than it's doing now. I don't want to prejudge the case, but I think it is largely indefensible that no one goes through this system and is released. It's not indefensible, a real serious problem. So you'll find the legal issues in the summary prepared by Dean Eric Janis that is on our webpage.
Judge Magnuson, I will attest to the fact that that is a very good website with many very useful resources to quickly navigate and get a pretty decent understanding of the challenges we face and the amount of work that really went into this task force and the recommendations.
Right. Mr. Chairman, if I might, Senator Rosen, one of the things that we asked ourselves right away is, what do other states do? How do other states who have this program avoid these issues? And so you will also find on the website an analysis and comparison of the Minnesota system with other states. How do other states do it? These recommendations have taken a great deal of their form by looking to New York, among other states, who have a more successful program than do we.
Senator Lurie.
Senator Sharon.
And I would just supplement that I think that this conversation is much bigger than what this legislation addresses. There are issues about how we deal with the original sentencing for sex offenders, whether we want to extend that or change that process. That's not what this subject is here, but certainly worthy of more conversation. There is maybe changing, having a discussion whether we believe that the civil commitment process is the right process at all for many of our sex offenders. That's a part of the conversation that we need. We've been having this conversation a long time, since Governor Pawlenty. And we struggle with the conflict of our important role of protecting the public with also understanding that there are civil rights for people who commit crimes, and that we cannot incarcerate them for crimes they have not yet committed when they've already done their time. So I really appreciate the fact that this bill, as it moves forward in the work of the task force, is engaging all of us in this conversation. But I don't want people to think that the answers to all of those problems lie in this. It's just an action that we believe needs to be taken in order to demonstrate to the court that we are struggling with this issue in a serious way, that we're sincere in that. And it's because of what Judge Magnuson said about you don't want the courts coming in with a sledgehammer. And so we're believing that if we are able to demonstrate some movement, some analysis of what it is that we're doing within the civil commitment process, that will we don't know this for certain, but we believe that that they'll be receptive to the fact that we're making some forward movement in respecting what the court has said to us about the seriousness of our our system.
And I know that Commissioner Jessen needs to leave relatively soon, and I thank you for being here to help with the presentation this morning. Did you have some additional comments you'd like to add, Commissioner Jessen?
Mr. Chair, members, Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. No, I wanted to be here to answer questions and to, I think Senator Sharon asked me just at a high level to walk through the fiscal note with you, and I have other people here who, if I have to leave or if there are more detailed questions, can answer those as well about the fiscal note.
Okay. And on the fiscal note, Senator Sharon did mention that it is still warm from being printed just this very morning. And one of the things that I'll just make clear, this is, you know, a bill traveling separately because it is a very, you know, difficult issue to talk about and work with, and trying to accommodate it in the broader Health and Human Services omnibus bill would have been probably an untenable situation. So we're running it separately, but we do have in the Health and Human Services omnibus bill the growth factor for the sex offender program if we do nothing. And with that growth factor, that gives us the ability to have a conversation about another approach and accommodate that approach fiscally if they work out with one another, and we can track that well within the confines of the Health and Human Services spreadsheet. So that's kind of the plan for how we're mechanically working on this. So we'll separate this discussion, but track the fiscal implications of it in conjunction with the $8 million, I believe it was, over the biennium for the sex offender growth if we don't do anything. So that's worst case scenario. If we can come up with another option, we have abilities to track that fiscally built within our tracking document. Senator Rosen and then Senator Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chair, has the sex offender program always been in the Health and Human Services budget?
Senator Rosen, yes. The sex offender program is a secure therapeutic treatment program and has always been in the Health and Human Services budget. There's also sex offender treatment offered at the Department of Corrections that's also run through the Department of Human Services. I think that one's the funding of that has gone back and forth a little bit, but the sex offender treatment program itself has always been housed at DHS. It used to be under the state operated services. I don't know, 2007 or 8 or something like that, we broke it out from under state operated services and made it its own division, or I don't know if division, but its own little thing, broke it out from under state operated services, but it's always been in DHS.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Rosen.
I hate to bring this up, but this bill has just passed the House policy. It's stuck in Judiciary. And it's probably got at least three committees to go through. I mean, I don't know, Commissioner, if there's a way we're going to be able to get this thing done. You can't speak for the House. I'm just saying that this is kind of an issue where
I think that, the ability to demonstrate to the courts, as Senator Sharon said, that we're really serious about trying to put the constitutional underpinnings behind our sex offender civil commitment program is absolutely critical, and we need to try to advance the ball. If we just sit on it and in the Senate, because the House hasn't moved it as far along as we have, I don't believe we've done our job either. So, I mean, maybe by giving it some attention, some thought, some thoughtful conversation, we can lead by example how we can get through some of these. You know, these are very difficult conversations, and nobody would contest that. The work that we've done on the task force has been really deliberative, but again, difficult conversations to navigate. And I think that by advancing this in the Senate, we're really helping the cause more broadly. And I hope that brings some additional impetus on the House to further those conversations as well, and really try to just get something done.
Yeah. It's
pretty important. And, you know, I think to Judge Magnuson's point, you know, that the federal courts, if they come in, will use, a sword or a hammer and not a scalpel. You know, that's not even a criticism of the federal courts, to tell you the truth. They don't have a scalpel in their tool bag. I mean, that's, you know, they open it up and all they have is a hammer. Yeah. And so it really is incumbent upon us to do this work here. And I think that we're up to it. Senator Sharon?
If Senator Rosen, I would be interested to know, if you don't mind my asking, that I'm in conversations with the chief author in the House, and I think there's still some sense, just like we're past deadlines here, that there's some movement that is possible in the House, although they're not certain. But I have been pressing to have this move forward in the Senate, because I think we need to take leadership on the sincereness with which we need to respond to the courts. And I'm hoping that the Senate will support that perspective, regardless of what the House is doing. Are you comfortable with that concept?
Senator Mr. Chair, Rosen. Thank you. And Senator Sharon, I absolutely am. I'm just raising the red flag that we are giving this due attention. I do believe that this needs the attention it deserves. But for if the House is not going to be moving along, they have a tremendous amount of work to be done on this. And I know some other issues have gotten waylaid because of their reluctance to move it forward, or they didn't think there was enough time, the prescription monitoring program, Mr. Chair. And, and so I'm a little leery about what's happening in the House. So I just publicly just want to say, if we're sincere about it, the House needs to get moving too.
Yeah.
Point well taken. Yeah. Senator Sharon, you have an A11, a delete everything amendment.
Yes,
too.
I do. I do.
At some point, correct?
Yes, perhaps I should do that so that we can answer more questions. I'd like to move the, it's an amendment because this has been through other committees.
Right, and it is what was described. It's what the fiscal note is drafted to. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So it's what we have been describing. So Senator Sharon moves the A11 amendment. Any further conversation on that? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you. Thank you for reminding me that, Senator Lurie.
Yeah.
It is a part of relating to Senator Rosen, that the author in the House and all of the participants that are working on this have been working very hard together to get our language aligned with one another. So this document, at least at this point, aligns with what is in the House.
So, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm remembering you had a question earlier. Sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. And I was going to weigh in on the same way, that it's really important that we get this done. And in reading through the fiscal note, reading through the bill quickly on the delete everything or so on, you know, the strict and intensive supervision and treatment is a fair and right way to do, whether the court breathes down your back or not. I mean, these are people that deserve to be treated in that way, and this is so well vetted and gone through so many things. But my one question, though, is in regards to this, because there was mention of some other states. So do we have a track record of this strict and intensive supervision type treatment program in other states, or is this something new to any state?
Justice Magnuson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, I believe it's modeled largely after the system, which has proven to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'll adapt it and improve it here. There is a separate task force appointed by the federal court of mental health professionals to actually analyze the design of the treatment system. My task force is concerned with the kind of the legal framework, but the substance of the program is also being examined, and it will be a significant improvement over what.
And Senator Kiffmeyer, as well, we had really good presentation from New York on their approach to this at a symposium over at William Mitchell a couple of years ago, and I believe that that presentation is available on the task force's website as well, if members want to take a look at that. And there's many variations of this type of approach to sex offender treatment around the country and around the world.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, I believe staff is going to not only give you copies of the legal point summary that Senator Rosen was asking about, but also a copy of the web page that has all these links. It's a very rich resource, and you can see the symposium that was at William Mitchell College of Law and the significant information there.
Senator Lurie,
Senator Kiffmeyer, a follow-up.
Senator. I know that the commissioner needs to leave in 5 minutes, so I would ask her to highlight elements of the fiscal note for you before she has to go. There are other staff here, but to highlight what she wants you to know about the fiscal note and its impact.
That's what I was going to ask about.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll go through this at a very high level, as Senator Sharon explained. First of all, with regard to the strict and intensive supervision and treatment, we have given considerable thought to this. Of course, it's very difficult to say how much this would cost since this is something entirely new. To build out this real continuum. In the fiscal note, you'll notice that we gave kind of a range of per diems based upon providers that are providing services that were under contract with us for people who are on provisional discharge. Now, this would be a kind of separate kind of an option for continuum for people coming in. But what it tells you is that there's a continuum here. There's some costs on a per diem basis would be less than at MSOP, some that would be more expensive. You know, our take on this, just given the uncertainties, is that we believe we can implement CIST dispositions within our current budget forecast, that $8 million that you referred to, Senator Lurie. You know, we understand that there are unknowns here. If there are a lot, this assumes that we have about the same number of people coming into the program, and obviously we'll learn a lot if we do this over the next 2 years. For example, right now we don't have, for the CIST programs, we don't know how many people will be there. We probably won't have the economies of scale. But we think the best, as reflected in this fiscal note, is to say that we think that we can implement this within our current budget forecast. With Section 2 of the bill, which refers to the sex offender civil commitment procedural training for those changes for judges and court staff, this is something that we already do a lot of this, so it would have no fiscal impact. On Section 3, which is the provision which refers to a public education campaign, we propose to do this with a contract with a retired judge, which we would be, you'll see the notes, about $4,000 for this. I think for the Department of Human Services, the more significant expenses come with the cost of evaluations. As Senator Sharon explained, there would be an evaluation done after a judge has made a decision to civilly commit, and that legal standards have not been changed about whether you civilly commit someone as a sexual predator. And then the decision is, should they go into a CIST program or go to MSOP? There's an evaluation, which would be a new evaluation, which would be done then. We're assuming that we would have to hire some new evaluators to do those evaluations. And our assumption is that we'd have probably have 1.5 FTE to handle those evaluations, kind of assuming that one FTE could perform 49 evaluations a year. The more significant evaluation costs come with the fact that I think very appropriately, Senator Sharon's this bill provides for biannual evaluation so that everyone in the program would at least every other year have that independent evaluation, and that independent evaluation would go to the Supreme Court Appeals Panel, which would then do the paper review and determine if a hearing should be held. So the cost of those, using kind of the same concept that we would have one FTE being able to do 49 evaluations, is reflected on, I believe, page 6 of the fiscal note. So those would be, if we assume 350 evaluations a year, which would call for seven FTEs, that's about $980,000 a year. There's some offsets to that, however, Mr. Chair and members. We'd be eliminating the SRB, and we have three basically assessors who do assessments for the SRB, so there would be offsets for those because we'd be eliminating those positions as well. We would also factor in the county share, which would remain the same as it is today. So no changes to the county share. And counties, as many of you all know, pay either 10% or 25% of the cost of care, depending on when the individual was civilly committed. If you look, I do want to point out one additional thing in our fiscal note, because I think it relates to the Supreme Court's fiscal note on this. You'll notice on page 7 of the fiscal note, for the Department of Human Services, we note that there will need to be additional Supreme Court appeal panels reviews, that we believe that there will be more. We now, through a memorandum of understanding with the court, pay for those reviews. So we had budgeted $50,000 a year for additional review panels. I note that because later in the fiscal note, the court comes up with a much higher number for what those would cost, and I think we just received the court's fiscal note this morning, and I think that is something we need to have more conversations with it. But certainly, it's duplicative, that number in our part of the fiscal note. Just briefly, Mr. Chair, members, turning to the Supreme Court's fiscal note on page 10 and 11 of the fiscal note, you'll note that they say that their cost to the judicial system of about $450,000 a year for the need for more judges for the Supreme Court appeals panels. Once again, I don't have the details on that. I do think that is something that merits more conversation. If there's someone here from the court, perhaps they could answer questions about that. The only other matter in the fiscal note here is a fiscal note from the Department of Corrections, which notes a fiscal impact of $73,000 a year to the department. I know that Commissioner Roy is here and is available to answer any questions about that. And with that, Mr. Chair, members, I am so sorry, but Governor needed me at 9:15.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming.
And I will be back as soon as I can be.
Okay. Any further questions of members? Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, Senator Sharon or Judge Magnuson. One of my questions already answered by the OLA report, because it refers to something you said in the beginning of the testimony where, we've been dealing with this issue for the last 30 years, since 1991 to 2003. The way we referred sex offenders to county attorneys at that point, it was about 26 offenders per year. And then starting in 2003, it became that all offenders who might meet the legal standard for commitment were referred to the county attorney. So it goes back to, so it grew six times its previous rate. So it seems like it's back to that issue of we're dealing with the issue now that we have a large number of sex offenders in the program that we're not able to move to society, and they're stuck in the program. But it seems like the problem is upstream. So my concern is what you alluded to earlier, that this only tackles the folks that are in the program. But what are we doing upstream? And I'm not saying that we need to lighten the legal standard of the definition of a sex offender, but we did ramp up and we did change the way we reviewed these cases, and there's such a thing as prosecutorial discretion. I just wonder what are we doing upstream to really make sure that we are treating those folks that need treatment, and we're not just dumping more people in the system, and we're just at the end of the day still paying the same cost because we're plugging more people than needed in the system. I mean, I worked at the public defender's office as a law clerk, and I remember reviewing a lot of young kids doing kids' things, and they're labeled as sex offenders for the rest of their lives. So I have a hard time, and I don't have the data of what the demographics of the people in this program are, but I still saw that as a big issue, because once you're labeled a certain way, that's going to haunt you for the rest of your life. So there's certain things that we need to view in the legal system, and I know Judge Magnuson, you probably have more insight into that. what are we doing, or dual tracking with this program, which seems to be something we need to do, obviously. But on the judiciary side, on the legal side, what can be done to address this as well so we're not just, you know, fixing things downstream, if that makes any sense.
It does. Mr. Chairman, Senator, one of the things that I believe that you have in front of you is the preliminary first report from the task force. And if you review that, you'll see that the federal court really divided the problem into three areas. And the risk of gross simplification, its input, how do people get into the system, treatment, what do you do with them in the middle, how do people move successfully through the program, return to society in a way that does not present a threat. What the federal court wanted the task force to do was address the middle issue first. What do we do with the people that are there? It's largely what this is directed at. It's very difficult to adjust one part of the program without impacting the others. So you'll see that this has gotten a little into the input part of it with the bifurcated hearing and things like that. But it is primarily directed at moving people through a system that will work. We are ready once the session is done. The task force stands ready to address the input and output issues in a more comprehensive way. But we need to see what's going to happen. So whether we change the standard of proof, whether we change the procedure, whether we recommend that there be significant modifications in the program, kind of remains to be done, but it is high on our radar, and it will be addressed. So we have a deadline of December of this year to make our final recommendation to the commissioner, who will pass it on to the legislature, and it will be reviewed by the federal court. And the idea of a December final recommendation is so that when the legislature comes back into session next year, they will have this under their belt and be armed with at least our recommendation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Claussen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 11, it talks about provisional discharge plan, and that each offender, if getting to that point, would go through that. And I'm just curious, what would be some of the provisions for that plan? I may be thinking ahead about how we're going to implement this, but I'd like to know perhaps what some of those provisions might be.
I'm going to pass that over to Rob.
Mr. V. Benson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Robin V. Benson. I'm Deputy General Counsel at the Department of Human Services. The particular provision regarding provisional discharge in the bill is there to reflect the changeover from the Special Review Board proceedings to this new biennial review with Judicial Appeal Panel having the first crack at it. But in terms of how the provisional discharge provisions will work under this new system, some of the resources that are being developed for CIST would, of course, be available then for individuals who are coming out of the program after being in the secure treatment facility. So that would they would have the supervision resources, the treatment resources, the housing resources that are being developed. When an individual goes into CIST or comes out under provisional discharge, a court determines what conditions are going to be imposed upon them that they're required to abide by in order to continue to be outside of a secure facility. The experience that we've had with the one recent provisional discharge is that those conditions are extensive and they are very thorough in terms of limiting that individual's contact with potential victims, with limiting their ability to, does not allow them to be unaccounted for in terms of where they are at any particular time. It requires ongoing treatment, requires a supporting network to be kind of encasing that individual in supervision and support so that we ensure that there is no reoffense and that the risks are minimized to the largest extent possible. So that will be both for individuals coming out on provisional discharge and those who are coming in but are being diverted from facilities into the CIST programming.
Senator Claussen, a follow-up?
Would this also include the development of housing arrangements? It's something that we currently do not have in place, like halfway houses, so to speak?
Senator Sharon?
The first article speaks specifically to that. It is a request to the commissioner that that she develop a system of progressive living situations, residential facilities that are highly secure, and also engage in intensive treatment. So that's part of what's not in place. That's why the bifurcated system is developed, because in alignment with the development of a range of options, there will have to be this process that there's an analysis done and that the court establishes these conditions no matter where they are in the process. Right now, there's just one option. It goes to Moose Lake. So that's why you're seeing these multiple factors, not just the RFP or the request for understanding what might be available for us already that exists that we can utilize for this purpose, but that's one of the steps of the bill, is the development of that system.
Thank you.
Senator Claussen, yeah. Another follow-up?
Yes, another question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a member of the Higher Education Committee, we talked about a real shortage that we're having of mental health professionals in our state. And as I look at this, we're going to be increasing that number of positions. And I know that we have a bill in place that we're seeking input from a number of the practitioners around the state about the future needs so that we can anticipate that and our colleges and universities can then gear up for that. And I'm sure that you will be invited to the table for that discussion, but I just wanted to alert you to that, and you're probably already aware of that. I think that'll be an important step in the process to make sure that we have trained personnel to implement the program. Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Justice, I was wondering, or perhaps the other witness can testify on this, about the SIS program, just reading the fiscal note and how we really don't have a program in place in the state, and that the, I guess, several questions, because it says on page 4 at the very top, there is not currently a SIS in operation in Minnesota, nor does DHS solicit proposals or bids for assists. So the costs can be possibly as high as the MSOP cost going forward, right? And that's it says that later. So I actually have a couple of questions. Number one, do we know if the SIS program is going to work? And where are we going to get that program and develop that curriculum? Or is it already in place? And number two, are we going to be able to stay within the confines of this range that is on page 4-2 at the bottom, between $238 and $405? Because at the very bottom it says, it seems possible from the range presented above that the average cost of implementing SIS disposition for a committed client will be close to the average per diem cost of placing clients in the existing MSLP program. So my question is we're giving a lot of range there. There is a possibility of it going over the high range, and then it goes further to explain that there might be a possibility of having to look at some cost-cutting measures, some additional efficiencies across the program, which I would assume we've already done because we've always been looking for money. So I guess I'm a little confused about how this program is going to work, where the curriculum is coming from, and is it going to fit within our budget?
Mr. V. Bamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rosen, first of all, regarding the prospects for success for the SIS program, as Chief Justice Magnuson indicated, this is modeled after what New York has had in place since, I believe, 2007 is when their law was enacted. And they currently, or the last numbers that I've seen, they have maybe 80 or so individuals who are under the SIS regime of treatment and supervision in the community, and they have a larger number of individuals who have been placed in their secure facilities. In terms of success, I don't have the numbers on recidivism or incidents with them. I've not heard an outcry in New York or in the literature saying that CIST in New York is not working, that it's not accomplishing its goals. One of the keys to preventing reoffense for sex offenders in particular, and I think probably goes true for offenders in general, is the role of supervision. When an individual is released from the Department of Corrections and is not being civilly committed and they have a sex offense background, they have intense supervised release, which lasts for a period of time and then is gradually reduced. The level of supervision that an individual in CIST or on provisional discharge is going to receive is going to be intensive and very, very long term given the individual's history. With that supervision, the success in terms of preventing reoffense and allowing the individual to reintegrate into the larger community safely, I think is quite good. Also, with the provisions that allow for the revocation of CIST or provisional discharge for technical violations or any kind of behavior that suggests that there might be an increase in danger to others or the individual, and pulling them back into a secure facility, I think that there are those safeguards in place that will ensure that kind of success. In terms of the financial success, as Commissioner Jessen noted, we have not done CIST in Minnesota before. Mm-hmm. We do have some contracts with providers related to provisional discharge, which form some of the basis for looking at these numbers. But different individuals will have different needs. Some individuals may need something more of a group home atmosphere. Others may be able to go to a halfway house and then some other kind of supervised setting or supervision arrangements. I think the commitment from the department is to work within the growth money so that this range of per diems is going to fall closer to what we are already, or at most is going to fall into what we're already using for a facility per diem. And frankly, the numbers of individuals who are going to be entering CIST probably are not going to be that great. We're talking there's about 50 commitments a year, so some percentage of those might be considered as candidates for CIST early on. So as this program begins to grow, it's not going to grow in an unmanageable way, or at least I would predict that we would have a relatively smooth startup path to be able to look at the costs and look at efficiencies as it begins to grow.
Thank you. Any further questions of members? Anyone in the audience care to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 1014? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1014 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much,
Senator Sharon. Chair, thank you. We've got, I believe, what now is, since the House passed it and sent it over to us, House File 779 before us, formerly Senate File 662. This bill in the Senate, this is ACA conformity is Article 1, broadly speaking, and Article 2 is market rules. In the Senate, earlier on in the session, Article 2 was changed to a rather intensive work group to work on these. Truthfully, that might have been a decent strategy on behalf of the Senate, because I think everybody's quite tired of the work groups, and it really kind of pushed the envelope a little bit, and all of the various stakeholders really sat down and did a lot of really good work and tried to come up with a set of decent market rules to provide consumer protections broadly market-wide. And I think that what we have here is very, very close to a broad consensus of market rules presented in Article 2. It is what was carried in the House bill. We have a delete everything that was the A1, I believe, is on members, been made available to members and also publicly here, that will step us through Article 1 and Article 2. The Senate counsel summary is drafted to the delete everything amendment. This is not a the first hearing for this bill, so I will try to describe it, but I'll describe the delete everything amendment as well. And as a preface to that, I will also say that the fiscal note is drafted to the bill that included the work group that we are eliminating in Article 2. So the costs do go away, and we can ask the departments to confirm that. But that is my understanding, is that the fiscal implications go away once we get rid of that work group. So what the A1 delete everything amendment summarizes the content of the Commerce and Health are both supporting this, as well as most of the stakeholders. So Article 1, again, is the ACA conformity, and it ensures that Minnesota retains its ability to regulate the health insurance marketplace. Included in this article are provisions conforming state law to existing federal law, such as coverage of children to age 26 on their parents' plans, elimination of pre-existing condition and exclusions for children. Rescissions of coverage are prohibited except in the cases of fraud. Coverage for emergency services without pre-authorization. Restrictions on lifetime and annual benefit limits. Strengthening the compliant and appeals process for consumers, and preventative care coverage mandates. In addition, Article 1 also aligns Minnesota law to federal changes that are going to be effective on January 1, 2014. These first ones are existing federal law. This next set are ones that will become effective January 1, 2014. That is the guaranteed issue and renewability, essential health benefits required, no pre-existing condition exclusions. Metal levels, that's the actuarial value limits, are established. Premium rate variation limits, the cost sharing and out-of-pocket limits, the elimination of specific benefit dollar limits, the clinical trial coverage mandates, and the grace period for payment of premiums for health plans sold through the exchange, MinSure. The changes to this Article 1 are primarily technical from the bill as presented, and the delete everything. They reflect the input of all stakeholders, the carriers, the consumers, the advocates, MinSure, and the healthcare provider community. And so I really don't think there's any controversy regarding Article 1. Article 2, again, is the market rules section, and this article provides for a uniform set of consumer protections for all consumers. It clarifies the continued role and the different roles of Commerce and the Department of Health as the market regulators, and it protects MinSure from unfair competition. The changes offered also reflect the input of all stakeholders, including providers, plans, patient advocate groups, MinSure, and the Departments of Health and Commerce. The notable changes in Article 2 include compromise language from all stakeholders on all of the market rules, including metal levels, which require plans that offer a bronze or catastrophic plan, also offer a silver and a gold plan, consumer information disclosures to ensure transparency but protect trade secret information, marketing standards prohibiting discriminatory practices that would discourage sick people from enrolling, and network adequacy, primarily based on the longstanding HMO standards in Minnesota.
to ensure enrollees have access to care. It includes accreditation, which requires a broad assessment of a health carrier, ensuring health plans meet a defined level of quality. It includes service area definitions, a geographical area where a plan can be sold and prevent discrimination. It includes quality improvement mechanisms for continuous improvement assessments, focusing on specific processes. Further federal guidance is still to come on this measure, and it also addresses open enrollment periods by outlining an annual open enrollment period in the individual market in order to prevent adverse selection. And again, deletion of the study group language. The interested stakeholders were able to reach this compromise, and we were able to delete that and, again, address the fiscal implications of this bill. Okay. So, pardon me, members. Senate fiscal staff was pointing out that sections 7 through 9 of the bill do incur some costs, but they were already covered through the exchange bill and covered as part of the withhold, and so they're already accommodated elsewhere. And wouldn't be carried as a cost in this. But so I think that as far as this proposal is concerned, there would still be zero fiscal costs, but it is an important clarification to make that there are costs associated with the language, but they've just already been accommodated elsewhere through the withhold that the exchange will be doing and need to cover these costs. And I know exchange staff are here as well as the Department of Commerce and the Department of Health to help talk about more of the details of how this came together and the fiscal implications. So with that, Madam Chair and members, we'd stand for questions. maybe I'd move the A1 amendment.
Senator Lori moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Any questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Any other questions from members? Any other testimony from anyone in the audience? Senator Lori?
I move House File 779 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
On Senator Lori's motion, any discussion, any questions from members? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The House File is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. That was the easiest Affordable Care Act hearing I've had.
With that, members, I believe we will be adjourned. And thank you for keeping us smooth on track.